Voy a ponerme la vacuna Prevnar 20 porque estoy en riesgo de contraer la neumonía neumocócica,
la cual pudiera llevarme al hospital. Así que preguntaré sobre Prevnar 20.
65 años o más, puedes estar en mayor riesgo de contraer la neumonía neumocócica. Pregunta a tu médico o farmacéutico acerca de vacunarte con Prevnar 20. Vacuna conjugada antineumocócica 20 valente. Una vacuna de Pfizer que puede ayudar a proteger contra la neumonía neumocócica con una sola dosis. Prevnar 20 está aprobada para adultos para ayudar a prevenir infecciones contra 20 cepas de la bacteria que causa la neumonía neumocócica. La aprobación continua puede depender de un estudio de apoyo. No uses Prevnar 20 si has tenido una reacción alérgica grave a la vacuna o a sus componentes. Adultos con sistemas inmunitarios debilitados pueden tener una respuesta reducida a la vacuna. El efecto secundario más reportado fue dolor en el área de la inyección. Para más efectos secundarios comunes e información completa de prescripción, llama al 1-855-213-2138 o visita Prevnar20enespañol.com. Pregunta a tu médico o farmacéutico sobre Prevnar 20. Si tienes ciertas afecciones crónicas como
enfermedad cardíaca,
asma,
diabetes,
y tienes 19 años o más,
52,
36,
42,
puedes estar en mayor riesgo de contraer la neumonía neumocócica. Pregunta a tu médico o farmacéutico acerca de vacunarte con Prevnar 20, vacuna conjugada antineumocócica 20 valente, una vacuna de Pfizer que puede ayudar a proteger contra la neumonía neumocócica con una sola dosis. Prevnar 20 está aprobada para adultos para ayudar a prevenir infecciones contra 20 cepas de la bacteria que causa la neumonía neumocócica. La aprobación continua puede depender de un estudio de apoyo. No uses Prevnar 20 si has tenido una reacción alérgica grave a la vacuna o a sus componentes. Adultos con sistemas inmunitarios debilitados pueden tener una respuesta reducida a la vacuna. El efecto secundario más reportado fue dolor en el área de la inyección. Para más efectos secundarios comunes e información completa de prescripción, llama al 1-855-213-2138 o visita Prevnar20enespañol.com. Pregunta a tu médico o farmacéutico sobre Prevnar 20.
This episode of Talk Nerdy is brought to you by Murder Book, a new true crime podcast hosted by best-selling author Michael Connelly, available on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. And also be sure to check out Dark Sacred Night, Michael Connelly's latest number one bestseller, featuring detectives Harry Bosch and Renee Ballard. Hey everyone, welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, January 21st, and I'm your host, Cara Santa Maria. I'm actually recording this intro from under my blanket in a hotel room in Santa Barbara. I'm here for a week of school because I go to a university that's got a kind of distributed learning model. I do a lot of my work online, a lot of my work direct with patients, and I periodically go to these week-long intensive sessions that require a bit of travel, a bit of get up and go away from home. Doing it right now, but I'm double dutying and recording this late at night. Guys, I've said it before. I'm going to say it every show. Talk Nerdy is and will always be 100% free to download. And that's really because of the model that I've set up here from the beginning. And as we've grown, about half of the income from Talk Nerdy comes from ad sales and the other half comes from my Patreon account. So Patreon is a really cool program. Just go to patreon.com/talknerdy and see how you can pledge your support. You know, $5, $10, even a dollar, all the way up to however much you'd like per episode helps to keep this thing going. And it's really cool because I know that it's being funded directly by the people who listen. There's forums for you to give suggestions, give feedback, let me know what you think. I absolutely love it. Speaking of ad revenue, you guys know that the model is that the more downloads we get, the higher the ad revenue because it's based on actual download counts. And so that's why probably the most important thing you can do for a podcast that's either just starting out or one that's been around for a while like mine and maybe isn't at the top of the charts anymore is to just listen, to share it with friends and family, to let people know about it and kind of keep that train going because I don't want to stop doing this. Do you want me to stop doing this? No, I didn't think so. All right, guys. But speaking of Patreon, I do want to thank the top supporters this week. And they include, let's see who we got here, Rob Schreck, Pedro M. Rosario Barbosa, Phil T. Bear, The Zombie Drummer, David J. E. Smith, Jeffrey Perez, Charles Payet, Jafe, Gabriel Felipe Jormio Gonzalez, Brian Holden, and Jeffrey Sewell. Thank you guys once again from the bottom of my heart. All right, this week I've got an interesting episode for you. It's a bit different. I'm welcoming to the show this week Sean Sheehy, and he's a visual artist who really, in many ways, is an engineer because his medium is pop-up books. It's beautiful paper craft. And in making these incredible pop-up books, he's also able to tell stories that have a strong scientific, ecological, and naturalistic bent. So we are going to be talking today about his newest book, Beyond the Sixth Extinction, a post-apocalyptic pop-up. It's stunning. It's fascinating. There's just so much to unpack. So guys, without any further ado, here he is, Sean Sheehy. Well, Sean, thank you so much for joining me today.
So delighted to be here. Yeah.
I am excited because this is probably your book. It's probably the most beautiful book I've ever had sitting in front of me.
That's kind.
First of all, did you know that I love pop-up books?
I didn't, but...
but also, who doesn't love pop-up
books? Who doesn't love pop-up books? Exactly.
I know. My boyfriend for Christmas a couple years ago, maybe just last year, gave me this stunning dinosaur pop-up book that has all these amazing, like multiple dinosaurs on each page. And there's definitely a similar vibe when your book, Beyond the Sixth Extinction, a post-apocalyptic pop-up, first landed on my desk, I remember thinking like, oh my gosh, this has everything I love. It has really, really beautiful art. It has intense pop-ups. Like they're really kind of detailed and interesting, and they're very large scale. This is a huge book. Yeah, huge book. It's science and it's a little sci-fi, but the sci-fi is all informed by science, and it's like super dark and creepy, which is so up my alley.
Right.
So thank you for that. Thank you for basically making this book just for me.
You're welcome. Yeah.
Yeah, you totally did that, right?
I totally did that.
Okay, so I want to, before we dive too heavily into Beyond the Sixth Extinction, because there's a whole backstory and I love this. I want to get really into it.
Yeah.
First, I want to talk about like you as a creator of pop-up books. Like, what a thing. You make pop-up books? Okay. Did you start off as an artist?
You know, I've been a book lover for sure, mm-hmm. you know, forever. And definitely one of those young people that wasn't terribly targeted in their professional aspirations.
Sure.
So, you know, I went as a undergrad studied education and got a teaching certificate.
Okay.
And saw very quickly that introversion was not a good context for teaching. though I still teach a lot, strangely, and
I love that. Oh, good. So it's like very therapeutic for you.
Yeah.
Nice.
And definitely have always sort of had visual interests. And, you know, I don't know, 20 years ago or something, was thinking about this question and reflecting on my parents, my dad, who makes furniture avocationally, and my mom, who during much of my childhood made clothes avocationally.
Cool.
You know, so here's two people who are building dimensional things with patterns here at home. And, you know, now here I am, you know, making dimensional things with patterns, essentially, and, you know, seeing how some of that kind of thinking and that kind of influence fed into that. But ultimately, you know, I just, I'm a tinkerer for sure. And went back to school after I decided that first graders were not my life. and I wanted to go into a visual arts program. And because I already had a bachelor's degree, I didn't want to redo another bachelor's degree.
Yeah.
So I went to this amazing technical school in Madison, Wisconsin, and got a graphic design commercial art degree. And as a capstone project in that program, it was very open-ended. And basically, I made a pop-up book as a solution to a problem. Graphic design problem. And it was, you know, very rudimentary. I had no training. I had no idea what I was doing. I was just playing. But it was very satisfying and it was super well received. Got a lot of nice things said to me about it. And because I was starting to show a little bit of this interest in this direction, I had a friend who said, hey, you like pop-up books, you know, maybe you should check out this place that's not very far from you, which at the time was the Center for Book and Paper Arts at Columbia College in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And so I visited there and was aggressively recruited.
Nice.
Second I walked in the door. And basically that pop-up book that I made as a graphic design student kind of turned into the, you know, this scholarship that funded my graduate degree.
Amazing.
Because they said, we really like this and we want to support you. So we're going to pay for you to go to graduate school.
That's so
and
cool.
I said, I will do that. Thank you.
Yes. Yes. Free nice. Education. I will take it. That is a rarity in American society nowadays.
Yeah. But, you know, and curiously, it was a fairly traditional program in the way that the, I'm going to go off into the book and paper arts weeds for a moment.
Okay. I'm ready.
You know, lots of people who go to grad school already have studied something, printmaking, for example. And so going to grad school as a printmaker, they already have foundational skills under their belt, and they're going to grad school to experiment and, you know, create and network and all of those lovely things. But nobody in this grad program walked in with studio skills under their belt already. Hmm. So, you know, we're taking classes in papermaking, not ever having made paper before, similarly with bookbinding, similarly with letterpress printing. So the program was very heavy in those things. And that's what I spent my time doing. And it was great. But ultimately, I only made one pop-up book during that program. And it was basically revisiting the version, revisiting the book that I made as a design student, but sort of doing it right.
Gotcha. And what was the kind of focus or the content of that book?
Oh, so as you will find out, as we continue to talk, all of my books kind of circulate in similar areas. Mm-hmm. You know, they're very ecologically grounded. And I'm interested in systems. Okay. So much like Beyond the Sixth Extinction is a study of the system, you know, and the creatures that are in the system. It was the same with that book, though it was called Counting on the Marsh. And it was sweet and lovely, where Sixth Extinction is not. and it was a counting book. It was a bedtime book, kind of hitting hard, you know, from my education training, all of these concept book tropes. So Counting on the Marsh, inspired by living in Madison, as I mentioned earlier, and this tiny little marsh on the north side of town there had some interesting microsystems within it that were being impacted by burgeoning Midwestern deer herds. And so there was conversation about culling that herd to protect the microsystem. And I don't know if you've ever visited Madison, but it's a pretty granola town.
Okay.
So, you know, there was lots of, we have to cull the deer to save the ferns, and lots of, we can't cull the deer because we love Bambi.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's an interesting conflict. It's an interesting conversation. So,
absolutely.
You know, the book is basically considering that conversation and looking at inhabitants of that marsh system, ecosystem, and into relationships, and, you know, basically, here's what lives here, here's what we value, you know, all the way down to mosquitoes. They're a natural part of the system. You know, let's give a shout out for mosquitoes as inhabitants.
I can't help but, you're going to be so like offended by what I'm about to say. Well, maybe you will. Maybe you'll find the humor in it. But when I hear you mentioning the marsh, all I can think of is that movie, one of my actual favorite comic movies of all time, I Heart Huckabees. Did you ever see that movie?
No.
Oh my gosh, you have to see it, with Jason Schwartzman. And there's this, it's about a guy who visits existential detectives. It kind of takes the piss out of like deep philosophical thought. It's really funny, but there is, there's a whole conflict where a big corporation is trying to clear the marsh to build a new superstore. And he writes like poetry to save the marsh. And it's very funny. So I highly recommend it.
The Huckabees.
I Heart Huckabees.
Very I Heart good. Huckabees.
I Heart Huckabees. Yeah.
On the list. That's funny.
Great. Anyway, so I love that. I love that you were able to kind of utilize. I always love when I listen to people's stories, especially where they take a meandering path to find their sort of true calling, to find what they love, where they can't help but utilize and implement the skills that they learned along the way. And in all of those things, it's so funny when people tell me, oh, I wasted, you know, X years of my life on this one thing that I ended up not doing for a living. And it's like, no, it informed what you do for a living.
Absolutely.
And so even your kind of graduate project there was informed by teaching littles. And I love that.
Yeah. And very clearly with this latest project, you know, that's still solidly in my head, you know, communicating to young people and figuring out effective ways to do that. And, you know, thinking about what they need to hear, you know, what I really want to say to them.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I think that that's a good entree into what they do need to hear. This book, it's, you know, it's whimsical and it's absolutely beautiful, but there is a very dark underbelly to it, which I think is important to talk about. So obviously in the title, it's called Beyond the Sixth Extinction, a post-apocalyptic pop-up. We are in, many people would argue either, you know, there. I think there are a lot of kind of, I guess, academic arguments about how deep into the sixth extinction we have trodden. But of course, it's almost universally agreed that the sixth extinction is kind of nigh within, within the Anthropocene. We're looking at background rates of extinction in certain species, like certain amphibians, certain frog species, 30,000 times the background rate of extinction. Mm-hmm. Like, come on.
Mm-hmm.
It's rough.
It's super interesting too. I know you mentioned the Colbert book, one of those podcasts of yours that I listened to recently. And it might be in her book. I don't remember. But someone also was speculating about kind of establishing the go point. And whoever it was, wouldn't it be great if I could remember?
Well, it may have been her. I mean, hers really is kind of the, I don't want to say the defining book, but it's very readable and it really dives into this topic in a lot of depth.
Yeah. And, you know, thinking about the idea of when humans, early humans, even first started their diaspora out of Africa, that, you know, the decimation of megafauna was in their wake.
Yeah.
You know, we lost the saber-toothed tigers and the woolly mammoths and the giant sloths, you know, all very, very quickly.
Yeah, and that was when our population was much smaller.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we were already that destructive.
So the idea even of thinking of it being a modern human problem, you know, is called the task a little bit. It's just human. It's just human.
Absolutely. And of course, even the term modern is so dependent upon the scale with which we view the universe, because the humans are a modern problem in many respects. We're only, you know, 200 plus thousand years old, if we're specifically talking Homo sapiens. But of course, human ancestors go back millions of years, tool use, all of those things.
Right.
But it is true, you know, from a geologic perspective, we are but a blip.
A blip.
A tiny blip.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, we are wreaking absolute havoc on biodiversity.
There's some problems.
Yeah. And that's really what this book, you know, talks about. And we're not talking it depends on if we're talking in geologic time. Yes, we're talking about the near future. Mm-hmm. But your book opens up with a conversation that the year is 4847.
Yeah.
And so we are on the other end of the sixth extinction, the sixth great global extinction.
Right.
But of course, even after the five previous extinctions that like you mentioned, Colbert so beautifully describes in her book. And of course, evolutionary biologists have studied for basically as long as evolutionary biology has been around. Mm-hmm. Everything didn't die. Certain things persisted. That's what evolution is, right? See that certain species are more adapted to, or are more adaptable to persist even in very difficult circumstances. They have a higher fitness for those circumstances and they thrive. Yeah. Oftentimes, though, those species are changed for forever because of that bottleneck. And those species are also often what we think of as being the more, I don't know, insidious, the more underfoot. I don't know how to describe them, but I think of a cockroach is what I'm saying.
Yeah, I'm
thinking of cockroaches.
Exactly. It's the irony, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And you have some arthropods in here. You have one that really heavily reminds me. Well, you have a cockroach, but there's also an organism that heavily reminds me of a trilobite. Kind of this,
yeah, similar.
This organism that I think throughout the history of animals, I guess, are trilobites. Yeah, I guess they would be animals.
Yeah.
You know, we've had something that reminds us, whether geographically you call it a pill bug. We call them roly-polies growing up in the South. I have some trilobites sitting on my shelf. I'm looking at them right now. There's always been this kind of arthropod organism that takes us that sort of segmented armored form, and you have an organism just like that in the book.
Scavengers that are heavily defended, find it easy to hide.
And who are, I don't know, just it's easy to hide, they're defended, and I guess they don't need a whole lot of nutrition.
Right, or they find it easily what they need.
Yes,
what
there they you
need.
Go.
Yeah,
there you go. Their needs are different than the complex needs of organisms that are maybe a bit higher up on the food chain. But actually, I just realized before we get too deep into the content of the book that you had a partner in producing this book, Jordi Solano.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that was the illustrator for the book,
right?
Okay, so you didn't illustrate, but you did the paper crafting and the writing.
That is correct.
Gotcha. So how does that partnership work? Is it just a whole lot of back and forths?
For sure. Though, you know, curiously enough, in the context of, you know, modern publishing, I have never spoken directly with Jordi, because, you know, that's often how they work.
What? Wait, didn't JR say the same thing a couple weeks ago on the show?
Did, exactly.
That he had never actually met his illustrator?
Though he, the difference, he worked directly with her.
That's true. He spoke to her at least, whether it be via email or the phone.
Yeah. With Candlewick, and, you know, a very competent, very talented art director, Chris Paul, you know, they included me in the search. I helped to make a decision as to which illustrator we selected. But once we did, she drew a really hard boundary and she said, you know, I want to manage all of this decision making. So we're going to include you in all of this, but I'm going to talk to Jordi.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's totally understandable. It's totally understandable. And like with JR, Jordi is Spanish, and English is not his first language. So there were moments where it felt like there were, you know, maybe some communication blips, but
sure,
you know, for the most part,
lost in translation.
Yeah. Yeah. But he's super talented, clearly. And
oh my gosh. Absolutely.
And it was really lovely.
And I can only imagine that, you know, you had an idea, you have to have, as a person, as a creative person who works with paper art, who wrote this book, you had an idea of what you expected it to be. And I can only imagine that having such a talented illustrator brought things to the table that took you by surprise and maybe changed your vision for the better.
Yeah, absolutely. It was, you know, and the idea of world building where... You know, I have a vision, but, you know, it's interesting, especially in, given the fact that this is the second time I made this book, because, you know, it existed originally as an artist book that that I produced in 2007. And, you know, as an artist book, it was just me. And I did not have any editors involved, and there were no fact checkers involved, and there was no need to consider market impact, you know, things like that. So in moving on to this version that would be a popular product, popularly accessed product, and published by a contemporary publisher, you know, they're very interested in, you know, filling in the gaps, basically filling in some of the gaps. Mm-hmm. And absolutely one of the things that he was able to bring to it was, you know, here's some of the, you know, the bare bones of this idea, you know, how would you like to, you know, kind of bring that fully in. And, you know, that very first spread, you know, the Roach is a great example, because I, of course, am also working under the constraints of, you know, the engineering.
Yeah. And financial constraints, because this book can't cost $1,000. Nobody will buy it.
Yeah. And he, you know, is virtually under no constraints visually. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So it was terrific to see then how he took what he saw as a pop-up and then made it into, you know, an illustration with a lot more visual detail to it.
Yeah. So you mentioned that because, of course, you know, we'll get back to the story and the concept, but you use the Rex Roach as an example. The book is full of these organisms that thrive post the sixth extinction, and they're all very, you know, wonderfully researched. And I mean, this is a very kind of science informed mm-hmm. science fiction story. But each spread has, or each organism has two pages dedicated to them, the beautiful mm-hmm. constructed paper pop-up with a little flap on the side that gives you kind of the important stats, but then mm-hmm. also a story page that looks, that's a flat page that looks like maybe, I don't know what Jordy's approach was, watercolor, maybe some sort of mix of digital imagery and watercolor. It's hard to say.
It's a mix.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So definitely it's cool because it has a fine art approach to it, but that also looks quite modern and digital with mm-hmm. this very 28 days later. Actually, I would love to reference for me. Oh gosh, it's one of my favorite sci-fi movies about it's the apartheid South Africa film with the prawns. You know what I'm talking about. Everybody listening is screaming it out right now. Apartheid South. I'm Googling apartheid South Africa, and it's at Weta Studios film. It is, what is the movie called? District 9. It has a very District 9 vibe to it.
Gotcha.
This that's where my head goes. Like this kind of crusty shanty town, dark. Mm-hmm. Kind of emerging from the ashes vibe. That's mm-hmm. that's beautiful in its darkness. And
of course
that really speaks to me because I don't know. I'm really attracted to those kinds of things. And even the way that you introduce the book is this kind of for immediate distribution to the regional survey team leaders, you know, from the chief scientist and regional director. This is a field guide to the creatures that you're going to encounter when you go on this mission in the district of, do you pronounce it Kago or Kago?
Kago, because Kago. It's, you know, a chunk of Chicago.
Ah, yes, that makes sense. Yes, this is post-apocalyptic Chicago. That's
right.
So funny. I didn't even put that together. And it's like, you're going to come across these creatures that have, you know, rapidly evolved
mm-hmm.
because what happened? What was the end of the sixth extinction? Was there a large event or is this all just anthropocentric or anthropogenic change?
Yeah. And just drifted to its natural end.
Gosh. Yeah. So this is all just environmental catastrophe.
All just environmental catastrophe.
Gosh. Massive climate change, massive habitat loss and just a lack of biodiversity because of that.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, so you're like, what is actually potentially going to happen if we don't get some, you know, regulation in place and we don't all band together to make some really intense changes?
It is a cautionary tale. It's true.
Oh, my gosh. And do you feel like you went, you took that cautionary tale to an extreme, or did you feel like, nope, I actually kind of tried to look at exactly what could happen with no changes?
That question asks about people. Mm-hmm. And original version absolutely did not have any human reference whatsoever.
Interesting.
And in fact, in my head, like the our chief scientist who writes this memo in the introduction, his name is Willick Muraday, which is also the, now the scientists in your crowd are going to scream at me. it's part of the nomenclature for rodents.
Oh, cool.
Except it's A-E, not A-Y.
I love that.
So he's, you know, in my head, he's an evolved and intelligent rat who is writing this memo.
Yeah.
But Kendawick was a little leery about being super grim about this. And there still are essentially virtually no human references. There is in the Rex Roach spread, but that's about it. So the idea of the planet kind of needing a break from humans in order to bounce back is, you know, is kind of, that's kind of part of the thinking here for sure. But, you know, I'm an optimist, and, you know, I don't think that that's necessarily the way it's all going to shake out, but does feel like there might be a few grim years in there when, everything is kind of getting itself all sorted out.
For sure. And I mean, I do understand the reference, for example, in the Rex Roach spread, where you have the, you know, lethal dose of radiation, and you compare different organisms, and you've got a human being there. And in my view, obviously, this Anthropocene extinction, I mean, by virtue of its very name, Anthropocene,
right,
this is a human-induced change. We're already well on our way. We're seeing organisms, you know, left and right that we're losing. We can directly tie that to human-induced climate change, habitat loss, all of that stuff, pollution, things like that. There's no real... Here's the scary thing. There's no real reason to believe that humans will be heavily affected by this. At least not in any great numbers. Obviously, we're going to see people dying in coastal cities. Obviously, we're going to see massive climate refugee status of a lot of, poorer individuals, which is the sad truth, is that kind of those with the least resources are the most heavily affected by the actions of those with the most resources. But that said, as a tool-building, technology-building species, we can buffer ourselves from this in a totally different way than the organisms can.
Right.
And so we could just continue, even as everything around us is literally dropping dead.
With the exception maybe of Miami.
Yes, exactly. Or maybe LA. we may be in the ocean soon. But you're right. I mean, there are definitely places on the planet where we're just going to lose land mass. And there are people who will die. I mean, there are people who are already dying. Yet, there are always going to be people who can wall themselves off and who can create new ways to feed ourselves and create new ways to persist in the face of this. And the hope is just that we learn that that's not the way to continue.
All right, guys, I want to take a quick break from the show to thank the sponsor of this week's episode, Murder Book, the new true crime podcast hosted by best-selling author Michael Connelly. Now, guys, Michael Connelly is returning to his roots as a journalist. You've read his work. I mean, I think you have. I have, definitely. And you've seen the hit television show Bosch, which was informed by many of his novels. But this new podcast, Murder Book, actually explore some of these real homicide cases that are usually not covered in mainstream media. He actually had the chance to work with the detectives who, you know, helped him write his novels, and that's why they're so rich and kind of so true to reality. He's also got a new book right now, Dark Sacred Night. It's his latest number one bestseller, and it features the detectives Harry Bosch and Renee Ballard. You can find Dark Sacred Night wherever books are sold. I think it is just excellent. He really is so incredible with his character development and with drawing you into the story. It's, you know, We talk about modern page turners, and this is absolutely one of them. So guys, I highly, highly recommend it. So you got to be sure to check out Michael Connelly's new Murder Book podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. You can learn more about it by going to murderbookpodcast.com. But also check out Dark Sacred Night, anywhere books are sold. Again, guys, go visit murderbookpodcast.com to learn more. I'm also pleased to be working with a new sponsor on this week's episode, Twillery. And yeah, we're talking about shirts, people. Shirts. Twillery shirts are comfortable, easy to care for, they look great, and they fit perfectly. And how about this? They're super easy to buy. That's the whole point here. They make these really cool shirts called performance shirts. They're dress shirts, you know, button-down shirts, but they breathe and they don't sweat. Who would have thunk it? Most performance shirts are like polyester and they feel kind of itchy and plasticky, but Twillery's are mostly cotton. They feel really nice to the touch and they're super comfy. There's no scratchy tags and they're wrinkle-free. What? They also are super affordable, you guys. $55 for a shirt that competitors would sell for over $100. When you buy in bulk, you know, the more you buy, the more you save. You're going to need more than one shirt anyway, right? You also get free shipping and free returns in the US. You get these free brushed nickel collar stays with every shirt, which is super cool. They make your collar look super sharp and they're tailored. You know, they're slimming, they fit really well. You can wear them tucked or untucked, however you prefer. So, guys, right now, you, the Talk Nerdy listeners, can get $25 off of your first shirt order by going to twillery.com/nerdy and entering the promo code nerdy at checkout. Remember, that's twillery.com/nerdy and enter the promo code nerdy. All right, guys, let's get back to the show.
It's also quite possible, I mean, I agree with everything you say, but that, and this kind of goes back to my interest in systems, mm-hmm. you know, is the idea that self-absorbed humans could, you know, say, oh yeah, we don't need Miami. So, you know, we'll move to Chicago because Chicago, you know, climate wise is now the new Miami and yeah. isn't it comfortable and great and above the high watermark. But the idea that, you know, losing something from a system, even though it may not seem like it's super important, you know, can have some impact. And that as systems fall apart and we lose more and more links to, you know, any regional ecosystem, that, you know, we're discovering, oh, all of a sudden we can't get our crops pollinated because yeah, exactly. you know, those creatures are gone. Things like that.
And all of a sudden, we have giant man-eating cockroaches and, that we have to encounter. They're not man-eating. They're not man-eating. No. But they are big, right?
They're big.
Yeah. So let's yes. talk about some of these organisms that you really it. Dreamed up, but you didn't dream up from scratch. They're no. really informed by yeah. what would be kind of fantastically expected in this fantastic scenario, which maybe is not so fantastic. No. And you really do start with Rex Roach. Do you start with Rex Roach because it's like, yeah, the cockroaches will inherit the earth. That's where everybody goes to first.
Yeah, it's funny. The sequence was entirely based on degree of evolution.
So the ones that were least evolved went yeah, first? Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And Kennewick just went with it because mm-hmm. there was no need not to, I suppose. But yeah, the, you know, choices were, you know, obviously pretty deeply research based. And I had read again, you know, who knows where, someone was talking about, it might've been a Michael Pollan book mm-hmm. about how the way we eat, reflects intelligence, and that if you're a cow standing in a field and you're eating grass, you don't need to think. You just drop your head and chew. Mm-hmm. But if you're an omnivore, you need to be pretty selective and pretty careful because, you know, anything is up for grabs. But you could kill yourself if you put the wrong thing in your mouth. True. So you need to be a little more thoughtful about that. So one of the criteria for virtually all the creatures in the book is omnivory, for one.
Sure, that's quite adaptive.
Yeah. Highly adaptable, absolutely. And definitely creatures that are highly adapted to living in a human-made environment.
Yeah, to living in a city with a lot of concrete, with a lot of garbage, with a lot of nuclear waste, things that we don't often think of as being fuel for for organisms.
Right. Or even, habitable.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Without some sort of domicile, some sort of buffer. We know how to cook our food. We know how to test our food for toxins. We couldn't just go out on the street and, persist without a lot of, technology.
Right.
And so Rex Roach, for example, although you say that he is, I guess, compared to the other organisms, sort of the most conserved, is that a good way to put it? The most like the roaches that we know and love today. He's got some changes. I mean, he's a big guy. Large friend.
Big. And, that was, all right, my brain's going in two places at once. nod again to Candlewick, who took a book that was much smaller, a little smaller, mm-hmm. and said, we want this book to be, as big as we can make it. And we'd like for any creature within it to be life-sized to your world if we can.
Love it. Is he life-sized?
Pretty close.
Nice. Yeah, pretty close. So just pretty a tiny close. Bit smaller than he would be in life.
A bit smaller. So in terms of publishers' aesthetics, they love the idea of things getting big just because that heightens impact.
Oh, yeah.
But, in playing with evolutionary principle and, again, going back into the research notes and noticing that, one of the reasons that bugs don't get bigger than they do is that they don't have lungs and they have to absorb oxygen through exoskeleton. And if there's too much surface area to volume, it doesn't support the organism.
Gotcha.
So evolving this thing and getting it big enough, and it gets these muscles, and then I go a little bit on a deep dive of the enlarged musculature of this roach that helps to get, the oxygen moving to the inside and supporting that larger size. It goes into that play then.
I love that. And he even has kind of like a panting behavior that you describe to help increase that oxygen absorption.
Yeah.
And he metabolizes radioactive isotopes, which is quite helpful.
Right.
I mean, we need that. Some remediation there.
Yeah. Which maybe is a good segue into that whole remediatory function that all of the creatures in this book play.
Yeah, of course, they never set out to play such a function, but we almost call it remediation from a very human perspective. They just call it living.
Right. Yeah. Adapting to the resources that are available. Yeah.
They just happen to be things that don't usually support life. Right. Oh, God.
Plastic. Yeah.
Yeah.
But it was, it was, definitely there were two layers to that. And one was me soaking my head in this material for years at a time and wanting to find a way to, find hope and optimism in this scenario. But also, wanting to, again, sort of communicate that idea that if humans kind of step back and get out of the way, the systems know how to fix themselves, and different creatures will step up and take on these different forms and help to convert technological waste back into biological nutrient and kind of repair the system.
Yes. Or as Ian Malcolm says, so eloquently in Jurassic Park, life will find a way.
Right.
It's true, though. I mean, that's why it's such a trope, because it is so true. We often talk about the fact that we are making the planet uninhabitable and unsustainable. But the truth is, we're making the planet uninhabitable and unsustainable for ourselves and other megafauna.
Yeah.
Which is the sad truth is the most charismatic creatures are the ones that are really, really losing out. Right. But ultimately, there will be organisms that persist and they will evolve to thrive in these kinds of situations. Like your clam fungus. They're quite lovely. And they like methane. They like methane.
Yeah. It also was, you know, go back into technical aspects. Clam fungus was one of the most challenging to engineer.
Okay.
And part of that is because the structures close.
Yeah, they almost,
while the folio opens.
Yeah. It's almost backward from,
so kind of backwards. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I love it because you can open and close. I'm doing it right now, and they almost are, you know, they're feeding, they're flapping their fungal wings, as it were.
And protecting themselves because they don't like the light. So when you open the page and the light shines on them, then they close
that
up.
And they're like, no, thank you. We're vampiric.
Yeah.
That's really cool. And they live for a long time and are these kind of slow but steady organisms. I love that it's a fungus that kind of had that, what do you call it, that kind of convergent evolution to look and act kind of like a clam, but they're not clams.
It was kind of a overriding creative principle throughout the book in terms of finding the creatures that were going to survive, deciding which creatures I was going to talk about in this book, and then trying to think of, you know, interesting ways to evolve them forward. You know, how their shapes are going to change, how their functions were going to change. And frequently it was just basically the mashup approach. You know, for example, Petey bug, that is the sow bug, potato bug, roly poly.
Oh, potato bug. That's the other one. I left that out.
That, you know, you take this creature and then you put a long proboscis on it. You know, like an elephant or like an anteater. And then find a way that could be useful. But, you know, the mashup is where the interesting morphing happens. And with the Rotrap, which of course is the last creature, and referencing earlier part of conversation, the one therefore that is evolved the furthest away from its 21st century version. You know, I was thinking about Stephen Jay Gould has a book about the Burgess Shale. And here's where science people are again possibly going to be shaking their heads.
But no, they're pumping their fists. They're excited.
And they're going to write you some correcting email.
Oh, it's story of my life, so don't you worry about that. Not because of my guests, because of me.
So, you know, so he's looking at the fossils that they found in the Burgess Shale. And, you know, it was a very unusual die-off. I think there was some sort of flood mechanism that meant that there were lots of creatures that were very quickly buried under clay, under silt, and becoming clay. And so soft parts were preserved.
Yeah.
So the fossils are more fleshed out. And looking at how many how the body forms were so very different, and obviously they were all much smaller than what we're used to, but, you know, some really unusual forms, and a lot of them that were radial. And he makes some sort of comment about how there's, you know, there's no terrestrial creatures that have a radial body form. The ones that continue to exist are all in the sea. And so, you know, I thought, oh, well, that would be fun. Let's build a land animal with a radial form and, you know, sort of invent a reason why that might happen and, you know, and how it could be an advantage. And so, you know, then considering mice, you know, if they want to live a life up off of the ground and they want to inhabit a niche, which is, you know, the interior walls of these reactor towers. And if they anchor themselves in position, on a vertical wall, then they're now like, you know, a barnacle or a sea anemone anchoring themselves. And then it kind of makes sense then that they would become radial and that their limbs would evolve up around their heads and they would have a reversible digestive tract. You know, they're all sealed up on the backside. And it makes for something that's super creepy. So
yeah, because it's also still furry.
They have too. Right.
Which is so this is your row trap?
The row trap, yeah. The
final spread. They're so creepy. I love them.
Love them.
And I love, they're almost cute in pop-up form. And then you turn the page and you're like, ah!
They're terrifying.
Horrifying. No, it's so cool. These, like, I have to say that I think one of my favorites, and maybe it's just because it's kind of cute at the same time that it's kind of creepy, is the pigeon, the brownfield pigeon. Mm-hmm. Because when I first opened the page to see the pop-up, I was like, weird, it's three-headed. And then I turned the page and learned, no, that extreme happened. Because that felt almost like too sci-fi to me. Like, that wouldn't happen, a three-headed pigeon. Like, we have no reason to, like, no examples of that historically. And then I learned, no, it doesn't fly anymore. It doesn't use its wings. They're vestigial, and they're little pouches to carry its young. So those are its baby's heads.
All right.
That's so cool. And it's also a giant pigeon.
And it's a giant pigeon.
It's like an alpha predator pigeon, which is amazing.
That's a giant, quick. Listener clarification.
Oh, it's big.
But big.
Yeah. It's double the size of a normal pigeon. Double. So it's like a turkey pigeon.
It's a turkey pigeon.
God, that's like, so gross.
Exactly.
He's got some meaty legs on him, though.
Yeah. You know, this is funny, too, in terms, working with Jordy. You know, absolutely, if you look at the pop-up version of it, very strong legs, very large feet, and Jordy pulling those in too, and just really pushing over into the direction of, you know, everything that a pigeon is, you know, from the thighs up, and then those massive legs underneath it.
Well, you got to support all that weight somehow.
Yeah. And it's a bird that runs now. So it's got to have the legs of an ostrich or an emu, you know.
True, because it can't fly. It's got to cover much greater spaces just with its legs.
Yeah.
Oh, I love it. I mean, it's so creepy and dark. But then the thing that, I don't know, just really resonates with me is that each new page you turn and each conversation that, this is all one conversation, but each new topic that we cover makes me realize that this was not just like I'm going to dream up a weird creature and then backward make it work. I'm going to do a lot of research. Like, you're reading intense evolutionary biology books to be able to sort of justify, to be able to describe what could really happen in this post-apocalyptic world.
Yeah, possibly.
I love that. I mean, obviously, possibly. You mentioned that you were a teacher. You mentioned that you're really have always been, or since you discovered it, into the paper arts. But like, what about the biology? What about the science? How did you first, you know, how were you first touched by that? Because it so informs your work.
Yeah. You know, it's was definitely kind of a outside kid.
Mm-hmm.
And interested in things outside. I don't have any formal science training, and in fact tested out of college level biology, so, you know, pretty much didn't study it after high school. But you know, one big sort of solidifying factor was that after I quit teaching, before I went to design school, I actually worked for the YMCA for a couple of years. And I was full-time staff, year-round staff, at a resident YMCA. So, you know, kids visited for summer camp during the summer, and then school groups visited during the school year. And I was essentially a docent and an educator. And kids would come, you know, depending on grade level, to study different kinds of programs that we offered. So the fifth graders, I think it was the fifth graders who came to study earth sciences. at camp. And, you know, so I spent a lot of time, you know, stomping around in the woods with fifth graders and, you know, talking about the way the world works. And, you know, that was something that really, you know, stayed in my head and solidly informs, where I have gone since then. And obviously the science of that was, you know, fifth grade level science, life sciences. Mm-hmm. And after that, it's absolutely just been things that I read to kind of keep me educated, but I'm a reader. So that's, yeah, it's a happy deal.
Yeah. How often do we get to really passionately read for our jobs?
Right. And it's a lot of, you know, just kind of, asking questions during the process, you know, and thinking, this is something I need to know, you know, where can I go to figure that out or to find out more about it. And admittedly too, I'm also a big fan of natural histories. And so it's one of the kinds of audiobooks that I like to listen to when I'm working. Mm. And so, you know, it puts lots of random facts in your head all the time.
I love that. Oh, I absolutely love that. It's, you know, it's really cool to see this convergence. I think as a person who, you know, for the last decade has worked as a science communicator by trade, yeah, a freelance science communicator, so kind of like making my own way as I go. I love to see sort of multidisciplinary convergences. I love to see fields that we don't think of as traditionally science-minded fields, or just fields that don't necessarily prioritize science. Because, of course, I think when it comes to art and art books, there's obviously a really important place for sci art, but it's usually coming from scientists who happen to be into art on the side. It's so cool to see people who are into art saying, you know, I want to learn more about science so I can inform my art from a scientific perspective. And on top of that, I have a very strong perspective on creativity. I actually am working with a professor right now in my degree program on a research project on creativity. I would say somewhat begrudgingly, because I think that creativity is very difficult to study psychologically. It's a very complicated construct, right? If we can't even define it, it's very difficult to find it. That said, I feel very strongly that creativity requires constraint. It's much more creative to, let's say in your case, dream up an entirely new world, but that world is heavily constrained by very specific information than to just dream up a new world and it not be constrained. And we see it in early childhood development. A young child, you can give them a toy and you can give them a fork, for example, and say, what is this fork? And they might say, oh, it's a trident of a great sea god. And that's very creative. They might also say, it's a car, and just go vroom, vroom with the fork. And you're like, well, that doesn't work. Like, that's not a car, obviously.
Right. There's no association there.
Yeah. And that's the real difference, right? The more constraint that you have, the more that you have to really work hard for that creativity to blossom. And I think that your book is such a beautiful example of that.
Make things believable.
Yeah, right. And also to really to have it so that, you know, maybe it's only 1% of your listenership or your viewership or your readership. I remember talking to the science advisor on The Big Bang Theory, and I remember him saying, I know that most people don't catch what I write on the whiteboards in the back. And I know that most people don't catch that one little change that I recommend making to Sheldon Cooper's dialogue. But, you know, for the 0.001% that do get it, at least it's not jarring to them, because nothing that's said is wildly incorrect.
Right.
And that's so important, I think, just for literacy in general. Like, people who read this learn about science, even if that was never your intention. And I think that's really cool.
Interesting tangent there. I would say, I'm gonna wildly put a wild estimate on this, that close to half of the people that I have spoken to who just pick this up and just start browsing through it assume that they are looking at an actual field guide.
Oh my God.
And the response is, I had no idea that these creatures, and I'm like, Oh, thank you.
That's amazing and kind of horrifying.
Kind of both.
Both. Like, so flattering and such a compliment, but also like, wow, where is public science literacy right now?
Right.
Yeah, but it is, you know, like we said, those constraints, it is perfectly believable. It is not that crazy a thought that in not 100 years, but a few thousand, as you mentioned, you know, it's the year 4,847 for good reason. And that's speedy. That's pretty speedy evolution. Exactly. But that's because those bottlenecks are really there. Those constraints are really there. That these things would really be taking over. But for somebody to say, oh, gosh, I didn't realize that there were giant cockroaches. I guess they're just not in my neighborhood. That does worry me a little bit.
Back to Miami.
Right. Yeah. Oh, man. Oh, gosh. I can't recommend this book enough. And I think that it's for anybody listening who is really science focused, which is probably the vast majority of my audience, but also just for people who, whether you have kids, whether you just really like to deck out your bookshelf, or whether you don't really collect very many books, but you're looking for something that's a little more whimsical, maybe something that's outside of your kind of standard area of interest, like go back to that place. You do not have to be a kid to like a pop-up book, and you definitely don't have to. You don't have to only like things that are kind of bright and cheery to appreciate these really beautiful, intricate paper arts. This is such a good, I think, conversation starter. And it's easy to read, right? It's short, it's condensed. You know, somebody who's sitting in you're having tea at your house, or that's such a weird bougie thing to say, but you put it on your coffee table, and like people who are just there, they'll be able to actually read it.
Right. Because I'm not a science writer, right?
Well, even if you were, I think that's actually a sign of a good science writer, is that you can get the point across in a very terse way, which is important, but also just to feel the paper, to see it, to see how it moves when you open and close the book. It's just really, I think, an achievement.
It's where a lot of the fun is, for sure.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, Sean, this has been such a great chat. Is there anything that you think we left out in talking about the book, about your work? I feel like we could keep talking for like an hour, so I want to make sure there was nothing on the tip of your tongue.
We hit all the big points.
Yeah.
In terms of what the book is saying.
You did write another trade pop-up book, though, didn't you? There's another book out that people can purchase if they want to see more of your work, but that one is a bit, it's a bit younger.
It's totally cheerful.
I love that. It's the opposite of this book.
I did that very strange Reddit AMA thing a couple of months ago.
Okay.
And I know you have experience with that. I saw that was on your feed somewhere too.
Yep.
And one of the questions was, is Welcome to the Neighborhood, which was my first commercial project, buy it online now. you know, is that the precursor, you know, to Beyond the Sixth Extinction?
Oh, how funny. This is the pre-apocalyptic book.
No.
Not intentionally.
Not really. But it could be. I guess that's not an unreasonable thing to ask.
Wow.
But yeah, like I, you know, my sister, she's terrific. And you know, she knows lots of kids who have babies, and this is her go-to baby shower gift.
Oh, for sure.
Neighborhood.
I love that. Yeah, not Beyond the Sixth. They'd be like, what are you trying to say?
Right. And I totally missed the baby shower market with my second book.
Yes.
Right. Sadly.
Oh, but that's so interesting. That's true. This, the first book does, you know, make for a perfect gift for like a young mom, a young dad, or older. Don't get me wrong. A mom or a dad who wants to read, you know, with their child, to their child, and with their child. Because really, I mean, what better than a pop-up book to make a kid super interested in the text on the page when they see it really come to life?
And it's also very sciencey. Mm-hmm. It's also very plain spoke, and it doesn't shy away from using some potent words, calcium, but it's sweet. Yeah, it's meant to be sweet. The absolute best review that I got which I found on my Amazon page, was from a Texan.
Nice.
Who is 5, who is part of the Young Mensa organization.
Oh, my goodness.
And it's tear worthy, just how, you know, sort of sweet and, you know, I love this book and it's about animals and it has a spider, so boys like it, but it has some pink, so girls can like it too. All right, hitting all the important points, my young friend.
That's so cute. Oh, I'm just imagining mom or dad helping out their little 5-year-old to write this Amazon review because they just have to get it out.
Right.
That's so funny. I love it. Well, gosh, Sean, you know, we're getting close to the end here, but I would be remiss if I didn't ask you the same two questions that I close every episode with. It's your turn. You're in the hot seat. So I would love to know, number one, when you think about the future, what is the thing that that keeps you up the most at night? Can't imagine that it would be informed by the ideas here in Beyond the Sixth Extinction. But then on the flip side of that, to end on a more positive note, what are you genuinely kind of hopeful and optimistic for?
What keeps me up the most at night?
Yeah, like what are you actually legitimately concerned about?
I, you know, as terrible and trite as this response will be, it's also pretty honest, I guess. Current state of politics. But flip side and optimism and go for a deep tangent to illustrate just the sort of continuing evidence of, despite the fact that we're kind of having an interesting little blip right now, the overall arc of politics is fairly progressive. Mm-hmm. Amy Stewart, who is one of my natural history providers that I enjoy a lot. She did a Wicked Plants book, Toxic Plants, and she's got a weeds book, and she's got an earthworms book. Mm-hmm. She's also come out with a fiction series about Constance Kopp, who is one of America's first detectives, deputies, assistant deputies in New Jersey, turn of the 20th century. So interesting, you know, story about a woman who is trying to have a job and not be married and support herself and her sisters, you know, in a world where men look at her and see her, don't see her, or, you know, think, oh, pretty little thing, go home and send your husband, because that's who I really want to talk to. Mm. So, you know, to think, you know, 100 years ago, you know, that's where we were politically, you know, compared to now. It's like, okay, things are getting better. In the long arc, things are getting better.
They really are. And I think that's important to remember for sure.
Yeah.
I think sometimes we do really forget that because in the moment, it can be quite overwhelming. There can feel like there's so much and we can feel very small and very ineffectual. But, you know, like, I think one of the greatest things that we learn from scientists is to sometimes take a step back and to remember scale and to remember, you know, whether we're talking about evolutionary biology or geology or cosmology, that, in the grand scheme of things, we are definitely trending in a direction that I think that we could probably be pretty proud of.
Right. So there's the optimism to hold up against the grim tone of my book.
Absolutely. But also, I wouldn't say the book is all grim. I would not. It's beautifully dark is how I would best describe it.
Thank you. Yes. That's lovely.
Sean, this was such a wonderful chat.
Much fun.
Yeah, thank you so much for sharing this book with all of us, sharing this wonderful conversation about it. It really was informative and just fun.
Yeah, have a good time.
Absolutely. And everybody listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus. Hey, guys. It is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun, too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino-style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.